This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. And this is Adventure Talks, stories about the trials, trails, and travels of Kenai Peninsula residents. On today's show, we're talking about emergency communication and location devices in the backcountry. Those little gizmos that can get you found when you get lost, that in the very best of situations can limit the amount of distress and discomfort you or a loved one have to endure, and in many situations can mean the difference between life and death. We will hear more about those devices and how they work in Alaska in a little bit when we talk to Lieutenant Colonel Scott Milani with the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center. But first, it is not hyperbole to say satellite location and communication devices save lives. In the studio today are two people who are still living because of one of those devices. As there are only two people in the studio, that means one of them is me. The other is Chris Hanna, who had the supreme misfortune of agreeing to go skiing with me on the Harding Ice Field last April. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
So short story, we flew up to the Harding Ice Field on Friday, April 8th, with clear blue skies and not a breath of wind. The forecast called for clear, calm weather all day, with some weather maybe starting to move in around 8 that night. We were going to fly back out around 3 p.m., but before our pilot could come back to get us, a blizzard formed pretty much right on top of us, and a storm front proceeded to dump about, 5-6 feet of snow in the next 4 days. We made it through the first night in a tent. That failed the next day. We survived the next 4 days in a snow cave, which Chris constructed by hand. Nice work on that, by the way.
Thank you.
No, thank you. And that's where we stayed until the Alaska Air National Guard dug us out and took us home in a very fancy helicopter that Tuesday. So if you want to hear more about all of that, please come to the Adventure Talks live event this Friday, April 28th at 7 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. But today we're focusing on technology in the backcountry. Technology has come very, very far and does very, very many wonderful things, and we can speak to that. So, Chris, what was it that got us found?
The InReach device that we took with us that day made all the difference in the world.
And we're not doing a product endorsement necessarily. There are a couple different of these devices on the market. InReach happens to be the one that we use. Spot is another common form of this technology. Basically, there's a GPS satellite locator. So when you push some version of an SOS button, it will send out a signal. And we're going to hear a little more about how all that works from Lieutenant Colonel Scott Milani. But it lets the rescue authorities know where you are and that you need to be found. And in some cases, you know, if you're out in a field and can spread out some rocks in SOS or can have a signal fire or something like that, you know, you can maybe get attention. You can get found without a satellite locator. In a lot of cases in Alaska, and definitely in our case in Alaska, that would not have happened without that technology.
Even if we would have had a satellite phone, it would have done us no good because we could have called and said, come get us here, but they would not have known where here was. With that device, they knew within 3 feet, every signal we sent was within 3 feet of the exact pinpoint of our location.
And why was that important in our case?
Because we were in the middle of an ice field, in the middle of a white blizzard with really no landmarks and no visibility.
Yeah, even in our tent, I mean, you can't say, oh, we're 50 feet from the stand of trees, or, oh, we're just up from the lake, or, yeah, find that hill and then look to the north. There's nothing. There are no references whatsoever up there.
And the same would be true if you were out in the ocean adrift, or if you were in dark spruce trees where there's nothing to stand out. Having that coordinate go out with your SOS message is really key.
In our case, though, we ended up below the surface of the earth because Chris dug a snow cave. We holed up in that, and then it proceeded to continue to dump snow, so we got deeper and deeper and deeper. So even if, you know, they had our location within a quarter of a mile or whatever, 100 yards or something, just flying over, they would never have seen us.
No, and not only that, but when they came, if they would have known approximately where we were, but not exactly, when they walked up to the snow cave, they could have collapsed it on top of us and ironically suffocated us while trying to rescue us.
And yes, that thought did occur to us while we were laying in there. Man, wouldn't it be terrible if when the helicopter comes...
Would be a little bit funny.
They land right on top of us. Yeah, I don't know that I saw the humor in that at the time, but in retrospect, I can agree that would be a little humorous. So these devices, they range in prices and they range in capabilities. The one that you had is kind of was an early model in-reach device, and it had the capability to send and receive detailed text messages. You had to pair it with a cell phone, which ended up being the problem for us because the cell phone battery then started to die.
Right. Now the newer versions have screens, so they can be either standalone or you can Bluetooth it to your phone to use the contacts and the keyboard and everything.
Right. And the cheaper devices don't have separate messaging capabilities. There's, you know, the SOS button, and then there's some maybe preset messages that you can send out. And you have carried these things and used them much more than I have. What, in your estimation, is the benefit of having the ability to send and receive actual text messages?
Well, if you try and call someone with a sat phone, you don't know if they're going to be on the other line. Just like today, we've all gotten so used to texting that it's becoming almost more convenient than calling, because you don't have to pick up, you don't have to answer. The other person doesn't have to be there at that exact time.
Can you imagine how awful you would feel if you were getting an SOS call and you screened it? Like, oh, I don't have time for, I don't know who that is. They'll leave a message if it's important.
You know, the other thing about these devices is that, let's say you are miles and miles from home, but the weather starts to come up and you're out on the ocean and you don't want to worry people at home, so you push it because you think, well, if I don't get home, they're going to be worried, and so I need to rush home, or I need to, you know, brave this weather. Whereas if you have that and you could just send a message, waiting here, you know, waiting out weather, it not only takes the stress away from your loved ones at home or the people that are waiting for you, but it saves the get home itis, which kills a lot of people and puts a lot of people in danger unnecessarily. They think they have to get home so they don't worry people. If you can just send that text message, then a lot of times people will feel better about waiting out a storm if they know people aren't worried about them.
Right. And if it does come to a search and rescue event, you are in trouble. You are not going to be able to get yourself out, and help is on the way, which is a wonderful thing. These devices are not magical. They don't, just because you push the button, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything will be okay instantly. So we pushed the SOS button Saturday afternoon, and we didn't get out of there until Tuesday afternoon because of the weather. So we still had to try and stay alive in the meantime, which was a bit of a challenge. Luckily, we were able to do so.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors that go into how long will they come before I get rescued. You know, they have shifts that they have to worry about. Their pilots can only be in the air for 8 hours at a time. So they look at, well, the pilot's been up on another mission for this many hours. Do I send them out now, or do I wait till the morning, or do I try and get the next shift? Or they're all looking at the weather, and they have to be, you know, careful with their safety and everyone else. So you don't want to just rely totally that they're going to be there immediately when you push that button.
Right. And I mean, travel time in Alaska and maybe the resources that are going to be best at that particular situation aren't available, or are, you know, hours and hours of travel time away. So you definitely need to be able to take care of yourself for however long that is going to be. But again, in our situation, you know, if we'd just push the button and they had the location and no ability to communicate, I think we probably would have still gotten out of there. There's hesitation in my voice when I say that, though, because having the ability to communicate back and forth really informed our decision making. And the discussion that we kept having, discussion is a kind word for it. We were pretty oxygen deprived, so having actual conversation was a little challenging, but The decision that we were trying to make is, should we dig out and try to get ourselves off of this ice field, which would have meant a 20-so mile attempted ski to Seward, although at that point my ski was pretty well buried in the snow and there's no way we were finding that thing again. But we had limited supplies. We didn't have an ability to melt water other than sticking bottles in armpits. Things were getting a little uncomfortable by the time Tuesday came around. And you never know. I kind of think if we'd tried to make that run at that point, it would not have gone super well for us.
You know, with the conditions, 20 miles with good snow is no big deal. But we were slipping through the snow or underneath the snow. We weren't staying on top of the skis. We were just slogging along. We were hypothermic, the wind and the snow and everything. It was just, it would have been a pretty tough go to get there. Not only the 20 miles, but then you'd have to get down the side of the exit glacier, around to find the trail, through the crevasses, all of that. It would have been pretty challenging, and that's where, again, the advantage of having the device is that it gives you the option to be able to say, all right, I can sit here and wait it out. It makes it a lot easier if you think someone is coming, someone does know where I'm at. So it gives you some hope. It gives you some calm thinking. Takes away some of the panic in a tough situation.
Right, because we were able to be assured that people knew where we were and there were resources on the way. There were helicopters. There was a whole parade of people with machinery who were trying to get to us, which was very wonderful and humbling to think about that many people being willing to help out in that situation. But if we hadn't have known that, if we were just watching the indicator light blank and not knowing what was going on the other side, we might have made different decisions and not have stayed in place, even though that's what all of the people tell you about survival, is if you're in a sheltered situation, you stay in the sheltered situation. But we didn't know what the forecast was going to do. We didn't know how long it was going to keep snowing. We didn't know. I mean, we knew what supplies we had. And after that moose ham ran out, we were getting a little low.
The biggest challenge you'll face, and anyone faces in that situation, is your own brain, your own mind, being able to win the mental game of staying put, of staying where there's shelter, staying out of the elements, because you want to just run for it. You want to go. You want to get out of there. You want to get back to safety. You want to get back to your car, back to town, back home, or whatever. And that's rarely the right decision.
And I think it really helped the search and rescue folks, too, to have communication with us, because they could ask, you know, what our health condition was. They could ask what kind of supplies we had. They could kind of assess if they needed to try and be more aggressive or not, which really, with the weather conditions being what they were, it was amazing they got us out when they did. But, you know, we could the first couple of days say, we're okay, we're hanging in, and they didn't have to necessarily try and push themselves beyond what was doable with the weather. One of the things we were pretty uncomfortable with the thought of rescue is, well, what if they try and they crash? What if something happens to the people who are trying to get us out of there? So it was nice to be able to have that two-way and be able to say, like, okay, we're present and accounted for. Chris is hypothermic.
Yeah, but not life-threatening. And yeah, it was good for them to know exactly what our status was.
Okay, so I think we make a pretty good case for how useful these devices can be. You haven't always carried one. I haven't always carried one. What made you decide to start using it?
My friend Jim Bristow got one when he and I traveled together, and I started carrying it, and I soon realized how convenient it was. It was mostly just out of convenience. I could call and say, oh, I need this scent, or I need this brought, or, you know, fly more something in with the plane, whatever that I was running out of. So it was that more so than I think I'm going to need it for an emergency. It was just more of my convenience and to keep people that cared about me informed.
And we have very different approaches to gear and to packing and to preparation, I think is fair to say. You're much more of a gear person than I am. I'm
a Nyman style expedition is grab the tent and start driving in the car, look at for a mountain and then climb up there and set up the tent. And then whatever the weather brings and whatever happens, happens, and we'll probably be fine.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. Whereas Chris's style of packing and preparation involves many, many hours with maps and forecasts and coordination and probably something involving an engine and gear that half of it is in duplicate, it feels like.
I've also been on the other side of the coin, and I've been in quite a few of them where it does go not as planned. And I've been in that situation where, man, you just give anything for matches, anything for more food, anything for a sleeping bag, you know, and you think that those things aren't going to happen, those situations aren't going to come up. But even though I'm a slow learner, after several times of that, I eventually decided I'm going to pack a lot of gear and I'm going to take the necessities, whatever I think that is.
And with these devices, they're not, I mean, everybody has a different scale for what's expensive and what's cheap. I would consider them not cheap because I am cheap. Anything over $20 is something I have to like think twice about purchasing. And there's all different levels and there's all different kinds and service plans. I mean, you can get a basic unit of this for $100+. You can get fancy bells and whistles for $300 and maybe a little more. I've certainly become a convert to using these. I carry one with me for two reasons. One, I am humbled enough to realize that no matter how prepared and planned and skilled and whatever I want to think that I am, I can't control everything. And weather happens and conditions happen and wild animals happen. And
you know, it doesn't have to be a major blizzard. You could just be on a casual hike someplace, just a little ways off the trail, and you could roll an ankle or slip and fall and, you know, break a bone, and there you are. You can't hobble out, or you can't get out fast enough, and you could die of hypothermia on a, you know, a couple miles from a road someplace if you're unable to walk.
And the other reason to carry something like this is, even if nothing happens to you, what happens if you come across someone who needs help?
You'd feel pretty awful if you had one at home and someone was at the top of Skyline and their bone was sticking through their blue jeans. They were in pain and agony and there's a, you know, rain coming or whatever, and you couldn't help them. But think how good you'd feel if you could just push that button. I mean, not necessarily Skyline. There's phone reception there, most of it. But you know what I mean? Anywhere, you know, maybe just on the way to Anchorage and you're someplace where there's no phone service and you come across a car wreck and someone's critically injured and, you know, minutes matter. You push that button and they get there and you could easily save somebody's life.
Definitely makes the purchase price a little easier when you're in, you know, climate controlled, air conditioned gear store, whatever it is, or you're sitting inside looking at a website, weighing whether or not to push order. When you're actually in that situation, and hopefully you never are, and hopefully you never come across someone who was in that situation, but if and when that does happen, whatever amount of money you spent on that, you would gladly spend 8 times over to have the capability.
Yeah, all the stuff that we spend money on today, it's nothing, you know, going out to eat or buying the newest phone, the newest electronics or just whatever. It's a small price to pay, especially once you start looking at camping gear, hunting gear, all of that. It pales in comparison to what most people spend for gear on a big expedition.
So we will talk more about this on Friday at 7 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. So if anyone wants to come and hear about our ski adventure, come to the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I will be speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Scott Milani of the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Hey, and thanks for not dying in a snow cave. Welcome back. This is Adventure Talks on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. On today's show, we're talking about location and communication devices Alaskans use in the backcountry. To tell us how they work and how an emergency signal becomes a search and rescue effort, we have Lieutenant Colonel Scott Milani. Director of the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson in Anchorage. Hello, Lieutenant Colonel. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Absolutely.
Let's start off by stating the incredibly obvious. Alaska is big, and many parts of Alaska are very remote with very challenging environments. Right? That's obvious. But what is less obvious is that no one entity handles search and rescue throughout all of Alaska. It's a network of agencies and assets and different areas of responsibility which cooperate and coordinate to get the job done. And the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center is a central part of that. So first off, what is the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center?
There's kind of an assumption that this is the National Guard, the Alaska Guard Rescue Coordination Center. It's unique, and simply put, this is a federal active duty Air Force mission. But it is the people that man the RCC, 12 full-time personnel, are guardsmen. So it's the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center. And so there is no responsibility inherent to the Air National Guard to do the National SAR plan requirement. It's the Air Force's. So, you know, and I'll give you just a little bit of an explanation so that it makes sense. And that is that there's international and national agreements and differing agencies that are involved, Department of Transportation, Department of Interior, FAA, NASA, Air Force, these Coast Guard, all these entities are part of a committee. And the National SAR plan states that the Air Force is responsible to train, man, and equip rescue coordination centers to respond to civil aviation search and rescue as a primary mission. So there's two rescue coordination centers for inland civil aviation search and rescue, what we do. There's the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center, and then there is the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center that's in located in Tyndall, at Tyndall Air Force Base. And they're responsible for that same mission set for the lower 48. They do missions a little differently, and they more so broker them out to the state. And the state incident commander of differing flavors will respond. Where here, really, because there isn't that infrastructure in the state, you know, and its remoteness and all the other things, we more, you know, execute the mission on a tactical level, in that we are directly coordinating, assisting, commanding, controlling the event from start to finish. So for us, a mission is over when the crews are back, debriefed, lessons learned, documented, and the survivors are at the hospital or released to civil authorities.
Okay. And what is the RCC tasked to do?
Our direct responsibility is civilian aviation search and rescue. So we monitor civilian aviation information feeds to determine if there's distress, and then we respond to that because it's our responsibility. How we do it is we ask Department of Defense, you know, so Army and Air Force almost exclusively up here, in Air Force and also Air National Guard, like the folks that came and got you, we ask them if they can support our mission. They're not actually responsible to do it. So we ask them to go get involved. Now, what do we spend most of our time actually doing? And that is assisting other agencies, primarily the Alaska State Troopers. The Alaska State Troopers are responsible for land search and rescue for the landmass of Alaska. So it's your hunter, hiker, fisherman, so on and so forth. The caveat to that is that within National Park Service boundaries, the national parks are responsible for their own search and rescue, land and aviation. Now, in application, what happens is that the way emergency locator transmitters, so your ELT that's in the aircraft, and if it's a 406 megahertz beacon, which is the only thing that the search and rescue satellite system has monitored since February of 2009, when that beacon emits, that information gets to the monitors in our ops floor. Well, if we, along with the Coast Guard, are the only two entities in the state that monitor that feed of information from the United States Mission Control Center. So when aircraft X crashes in a National Park Service boundary, if the only way anybody knows about it is that a 406 beacon ELT starts emitting, we find out about it at the RCC. We notify the National Park Service, you have a beacon going off in your park. Hopefully the person has registered it, so we have all sorts of registration information on who owns the beacon and the aircraft it's in and so on and so forth. And so we provide that to them. Now, in most cases, they will ask for assistance during that phone call. So a lot of what we do is assist other agencies. So we will assist the National Park Service with either land or ground search and rescue in their park boundaries when they're not able. And we will assist the state troopers for land search and rescue for all the other lands, which is obviously the larger portion of the state. So even though we are, by national guidance, directed to have civil aviation search and rescue as our primary objective, we spend most of our time assisting other agencies with their primary objective, because the highest capabilities in this state that are required typically are rotor wing assets, helicopters that can, you know, get off a road system and locate, and of course all the, there's fixed wing assets that support that as well. But the only way to get access to those assets is through the Rescue Coordination Center. So, you know, we in effect then really prosecute a lot of those missions for those agencies. A little bit of another misnomer is that what we do is just automatically call the Air National Guard. And, you know, and I think people see the National Guard patch on our flight suits and assume, well, we just launch the National Guard. But what we're doing is looking for capability. So depending on where it's at, we can use active duty Army. We can reach out to the Coast Guard, you know, and or Army Guard, Air National Guard. So we're just looking to, and Civil Air Patrol. So all DOD military entities that could support this. And then the Civil Air Patrol being an auxiliary of the Air Force, we can also task, request to task them to support missions in the state.
And that's not even everybody involved in search and rescue in Alaska. You could have somebody with an entirely different patch on their shirt come and help you out, right?
Yeah, it less common, but yes. I quick story, I had a mission several years back. A guy was out hunting, crashed his light aircraft, beacon went off, and we called to the state troopers who happened to have a department or a fish and wildlife trooper out in the area, you know, conducting, you know, discussions with, you know, hunters out there. They responded to the location. He landed his Super Cub next to the burning aircraft, pulled the guy out of the aircraft, you know, put the fire out on the outside of his Carhartts, threw him in the back of the Super Cub, and flew him back to Dillingham. So it was our responsibility to do that mission because it was civil aviation, but we reached out to the state troopers, and they were able to assist us. You know, so in most instances, it's the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center assisting other agencies because we have access to those military assets. But definitely the Coast Guard, National Park Service, Alaska Rescue Coordination Center, and Alaska State Troopers, we work really well together in a collaborative nature, always communicating about what the other one is doing, you know, so that we can leverage all those capabilities to, you know, get to what everybody wants the conclusion to be, and that is, you know, someone retrieved to safety.
So that's how you respond. Now, how do you know when you need to respond? What devices notify you that there is an emergency?
If it's a 406 megahertz beacon, which can be an ELT that goes in an aircraft, a PLB, which is, you know, your handheld device that you know, ACR is one common brand that people will go out with, that's a personal locator beacon, or an EPIRB, which is a maritime emergency beacon in a ship, in a vessel. all 406, all function exactly the same way, and that signal gets to us through the satellite, through United States Mission Control Center, to us. So we, along with the Coast Guard, monitor that and get that information. Based on the location of that beacon, it will be either the primary responsibility for us to execute or to notify the appropriate agency, NPS, say National Park Service or the Alaska State Troopers. Or if it's maritime, of course, then the Coast Guard will respond. But we'll work together collaboratively, because there's many times that the Coast Guard's asked us for assistance, and we have on occasion asked them for assistance. So that's the 406 beacon. The other primary emergency notification device is a SENS device, satellite emergency notification, right? So that's your in-reach spot. And there's a few other differing types of device, like spider tracks works a little differently. But the two primary ones out there are spot and in-reach. And you're using one of two satellite systems. Spot, of course, uses the Globalstar network, and InReach uses the Iridium satellite network. But both of those devices, once the either satellite system picks it up, that signal is transmitted and disseminated to the International Emergency Response Coordination Center, which is a civilian entity in Texas. And they're international, so they're receiving information globally. And what they then do is, say, in the instance of Alaska, is they will call the appropriate entity that they have on file for who would respond to it. So they'll look, and it may be the Alaska State Trooper Dispatch. It may be the Kenai Fire Department. It's an evolving process for them for finding the right civil authority or emergency responder to do that. So they will call them first. Every once in a while, they'll call us, but typically they will call, in most instances here, the Alaska State Troopers. So that's how that those devices work, and who's notified first. Now, it gets back to the first portion of the conversation, that if it's the Alaska State Troopers, it's their responsibility. They determine they can't execute the mission and they need support, then they will call us. And we will get involved in most instances, take over the entire mission, sometimes support their efforts, but a lot of the time we'll actually just do the mission ourselves. So that's really, you know, your, as far as your emergency communication devices, you know, those two groupings. Now, of course, satellite phones, right? Same satellite systems, but it's simply a phone, and they can call 911, they can call us, they can call whomever they want. And then the UHF, and VHF radios, so, you know, those are line of sight, so it's going to have to be somebody who can hear your transmission, but that information could be conveyed. I mean, the FAA will get Maydays, someone calling on just the normal air traffic control frequency, or calling on 121.5 on guard and stating their distress situation, and the FAA will immediately call us. When it's aviation. So that line of sight radio capability would be another, you know, way that someone would communicate their distress situation.
What about cell phones? That's not ideal because you don't get coverage everywhere in the state, but it's certainly expanding quite a bit.
Right. On the road system, most of it, reasonably good reception. Now, one of the things that we have the ability to do is cell phone forensics. So even if an individual's phone is on and they're not using it, we can request assistance through the Civil Air Patrol, the National Radar Analysis Team, to do cell phone forensics to narrow down the search or the search area. And depending on the number of towers that are involved that can pick up that signal, can tighten up the search area, which is very helpful.
From your perspective, what is the benefit to carrying one of these devices?
You've got over 660,000 square miles in the landmass of Alaska, very limited road system. And if no one knows you're in distress, then no one's coming to help. I mean, it's really that simple. And it's, you know, very important whether you're going out in a boat or you're going to fly an aircraft or you're going to go on an overnight hiking trip to have a trip plan, a flight plan, a float plan, so that someone knows where you're going and when you should be coming back. You know, and that's important. And we've used that information to help determine if someone's in distress and then where we would go search. But those are passive mechanisms, because until you're overdue, no one's concerned about your, you know, situation. Where obviously with any of the emergency beacons or other communication devices we talked about, we'll typically know immediately when it's a 406 beacon, there will be immediate notification. When it's a send device, it's immediate notification to the IERCC, who will call someone in the state, and that information will flow to us pretty quickly. And if we're responsible and or we can help, then we get involved pretty quickly. But other than that, you know, it may be a long time for help to get there.
After an emergency signal is sent, do these devices keep relaying location, or is it a one-time signal? And how close do the devices get the rescuers?
406 beacons are updating minute by minute. So we will be able to monitor that and note if there's any disparity in location with a 406 beacon. And it's important to note that 406 beacons have a probability of error of about 3 miles. So that's going to get us to a very close location to where you're at, sometimes down to 1 mile. Now, a lot of 406 beacons are GPS encoded. So once that device, either internally or through visibility to a GPS, you know, positioning satellite, it will upload the GPS coordinates. And once we have the GPS coordinates, we literally have driving instructions. So we'll know, you know, within yards where that device is at.
How accurate are the signals? Are there ever instances where, you know, somebody's down in a valley or in a mountain pass or something? Can that affect accuracy of the signal?
GPS signal, once you get coordinates, they're going to be near foolproof. I've never saw an instance where there was an issue with that. 406 beacon is normally more refined in providing location than the legacy system using 121.5. But 406, depending on the strength of the device that's emitting it and its location, if it's in and around mountains that can deflect the signal, it's not unusual to see locations or reported locations move 5-10 miles. But typically, they'll stay within an area and start, you know, tightening up, if you will, so that the more satellites that see it from differing positions will improve the accuracy. But obviously what it's done is that it's allowed us to know that there's a potential distress situation and where we need to focus our search efforts. So, you know, that's definitely a smaller area than 660,000 square miles. And then as the beacon updates and provides a more refined position, and or if the GPS provides a, you know, very accurate position, we are communicating that to the rescuers in the field to, you know, improve or to refine their search area.
How has the technology improved, and what impact has that had on search and rescue in Alaska?
406 beacons are monitored globally through the three different satellite systems within the COSPAT-SAR satellite system. What has came online in the last year is the MEOSAR, Middle Earth Orbit Satellite System. And what that has done is two things. One, it's provided for better coverage above 70 degrees north. So that has been much improved since that satellite system came on board. And the persistence that we've noted, that we will get updates in less than 5 minutes intervals of beacons where in the past, sometimes it would be 15, 20, maybe even 30 minutes before a satellite would be able to pass over and listen for the beacon. So with that third satellite system online, it is markedly improved, the frequency of updates and the accuracy of beacons that are, in the polar regions. The leap in technology to the 406 beacon has improved our ability to search and locate and rescue individuals. But what has occurred concurrently, and more specific to the aviation area, is that in general aviation, you're not required to have a 406 beacon on your aircraft. So for every pilot that's flying with a 121.5 beacon, and if they have an incident, an event where their beacon goes off, their ELT, the satellites are not picking up that signal and sending it to us. So again, nobody knows you're in distress unless an aircraft or someone on the ground, an airport tower, happens to be monitoring 121.5 and hears the beacon. But here's the difference. If you crash your aircraft, your general aviation aircraft, out in the middle of nowhere, and your 121.5 beacon is emitting, and then one of the aircraft that are transiting the area, whether it's commercial or private, say at 10,000 feet, they hear the ELT, and they mark on their map where they heard it, and they report it to us. If that aircraft is at 10,000 feet, and we then do an ellipse to determine where could that beacon have been emitting from based on where it was heard, that provides a 62,000-mile search area that we're going to have to cover. So if you take that 62,000-square-mile search area and a search and rescue aircraft starts searching that through a grid system, it could take upwards of 1,000 hours just to cover that 62,000-square-mile area. So really, with just that information, it's not enough to immediately execute a search and rescue. We'll continue to gather information. We will work with the FAA, determine if someone is overdue. We'll talk with Anchorage Center and other agencies to determine if they have been communicated with somebody and lost communication. If someone has an overdue flight plan, we'll use all other avenues to determine if there's distress and how we narrow down a search area. But you can compare that 62,000 square mile search area to a 406 beacon that is going to likely give us a 3-mile radius. And if it's GPS encoded, it's going to be measured in yards. So, with the advent of the 406 beacon coming on board, that's been great, but it's created a problem set now for the 121.5 beacon because it was previously monitored and is now no longer monitored.
So the impact for search and rescue is time. 1,000 hours because you don't have a precise location versus immediate deployment to a location measured in yards.
Well, with that previous example, when we're looking at 1,000-plus hours to commit to searching in an area for distress, it's going to be hours, if not potentially days, before we can narrow down an area to have a effective search plan and direct rescue vehicles into that area. Versus if it's a 406 beacon, we assume distress and we can immediately launch assets to a very refined location. Now, of course, there's always factors of weather, location. If it's 500 miles away from the nearest aircraft that can respond, and it's terrible weather, then that's going to complicate the response and could extend the time before a rescue vehicle is on scene. But at least we know where, in the instance of the 406 beacon, we know where that distressed person or individuals are at, and we are able to start immediately prosecuting a rescue mission. If you don't have an emergency notification device and or you have a 121.5 that someone is not within line of sight to hear, then it's back to someone noting that you are overdue, whether your flight plan shows you overdue reaching your destination or your trip plan or float plan that you have filed with an agency and or family or friends, and they note that you're overdue. So the timeliness is markedly different.
So these are impressive devices, but they're not necessarily immediate solutions. There's still travel time, there's, you know, weather or conditions that can delay a rescue effort. So just because you send an emergency signal doesn't mean somebody's going to be there to get you in the next 10 minutes. So in the meantime, you've still got to take care of yourself. What should people be doing to ensure survival until the rescuers can arrive?
Right. Well, as you stated, what's imperative is that when you go out for whatever event it is, be prepared to spend the night. In your instance, you spent several evenings in a snow cave. And so without the ability to survive until rescuers can get there, you're not coming home. So as far as directing rescue resources to your specific location, we're talking signaling devices. And so there's very cheap options that anybody can have in their back pocket or their backpack when they go out. I would say, you know, during the day, just a very small mirror can be seen from miles away if it's flashed at an aircraft or somebody that happens to be hiking on another ridge. Bright colored panels, orange, cerise, or other, that can be laid out on the ground that obviously are bright in color, not looking like their natural habitat and not looking man-made, that will attract attention from the air as well. And smoke signals, whether it's a fire or a flare, a smoke signal that will, you know, produce smoke again that will capture somebody's attention. At night, it's the light source. With the differing, even visible light from, say, Civil Air Patrol aircraft that are flying over, it'd be surprising how far you can see just a simple light source. I did one particular mission years back, and a sheep hunter had fell down the mountainside, and his buddy had then hiked down to the bottom and called it 911, and it eventually went through the process to where he got to the Rescue Coordination Center, and they dispatched the Air National Guard to go out on scene. So I happened to be flying that weekend and got out on scene, very bad weather, searching for the sheep hunter. We had approximate location of where he was at and very limited visibility at night. We're flying on night vision goggles. And on about the second or third pass in the area, the left scanner thought that he had seen something. So we made another pass. And then we all saw a just faint flicker of light through our night vision goggles. And upon further investigation, it was the hunter using a Bic lighter, and he was flicking it, but the wind was blowing it out. So we were only seeing it for a few seconds at a time. And just simply that Bic lighter enabled us to get on location and find him and get him to safety, and he survived. So, any light source at night is effective, but planning ahead, I would have either a small portable strobe device, a flashlight, a flare, and even a cell phone that you have with you. One, if you can, leave it on, because if you're in an area where there is any type of reception at all, that may be something that can be used to locate you through that cell phone forensics we talked about, but also use that cell phone as a light source. Be ready for all weather. Assume that they're going to stay longer than they anticipate. Have any medication that's required for them to take with them, and have enough water and either food or ability to get food if possible. Water probably being the most important. And then I would say, a knowledge of first aid and at least some basic first aid equipment so that they can, preserve themselves through that golden hour where there's an event that happens and either apply first aid to themselves or, you know, to a buddy and keep them alive until rescue forces can get there.
And what is the golden hour?
Well, you know, typically if you get someone in a situation that, there's bleeding or, you know, some, you know, major trauma, trying to keep them alive for that first hour, you know, and if you can keep them stable, then that person has a decent chance of living, you know, all things being equal. And, you know, that's imperative, obviously, then, so when rescue forces get there, they can provide a higher level of care.
You mentioned earlier registering your beacon. What is the importance of that?
406 beacons, whether it's the PLB, ELT, or EPIRB variety, are required by FCC regulations to be registered. And that's simply registering through NOAA to let them know who owns the device, and it allows you to provide information about what you typically do and the equipment you have, who, how many people you typically travel with, or maybe any pre-existing medical conditions. But what it does is it provides information so that when we get information on an emergency beacon that's emitting, whether it's an ELT or a PLB, we can call those contacts on that registration. So we will know the person was going from point A to point B that may help if the 406 beacon signal is not refined. It will tell us the number of people in the party, maybe pre-existing medical conditions, any type of survival equipment they have. So it provides a tremendous amount of information for us to help prosecute the mission. What it does also concurrently, in a lot of instances with ELT, aviation 406 beacons, they're accidental activation. Most all 406 beacon activations in Alaska are accidental. If the beacon's registered, we can call the owner or the family and end up talking to the person, and they tell us an accidental activation, and we say, great, and we close out the incident, and no harm, no foul. So, you know, I think that's really important for people to understand that that registration allows us to make that contact, whether it's non-distress or distress, and that there is no harm in accidentally activating a beacon. You know, the only thing that we request is that if that beacon is activated, even for a few seconds, is to call the Rescue Coordination Center and let us know that it was activated, because we will likely now, especially with the MEOSAR satellite system in play, we will have picked up that beacon. And it obviously reduces the number of man hours that we put towards that event, and we can then focus on something else. So there is no retribution whatsoever to accidentally activate one. It's just simply call and let us know what happened, and there's no, you know, it helps everybody out.
Is there a similar registration process with the SENS devices, like a SPOT or InReach?
It typically, with all SENS devices, they're registered with the company that you have purchased them from, and obviously, the more information you provide, when the IERCC down in Texas gets that information, they can forward that to the appropriate agency that they call, whether it's the state troopers or whomever. So, you know, it's the more information you can provide, it will definitely improve the response.
All right. I'm sold, although I've already seen firsthand what a difference these devices can make, so I'm certainly an easy crowd. Why doesn't everyone carry something like this?
You know, I would say that from the Rescue Coordination Center perspective, I think there is some concern, say, for instance, cost, that if I come and get rescued by a military aircraft, that they're going to charge me. The Rescue Coordination Center cannot charge. The military cannot charge for services. So concurrently, especially in aviation, we're also not interested in why there was an incident, and we're not doing any investigating on the event. The Rescue Coordination Center and the personnel here are interested in one thing, and that one thing only, and that is to rescue Alaskans in distress. And once they are to a place of safety, then our interest is over. We are not going to charge. We're not going to investigate. We are not going to provide information. We are, you know, are simply there to provide a service to the public and then wish them well.
Okay, so that diffuses apprehensions someone might have about the ramifications of being rescued. Although I will point out that there could be a cost incurred in a search and rescue effort in Alaska. If, for instance, you end up in an ambulance in an EMS jurisdiction that charges for transport, then you or your health insurance might be getting a bill for that service. Troopers also don't charge for rescue services in a state helicopter or plane. But if they send a private asset to get you, you could be on the hook for that cost. So if, say, a LifeMed helicopter plucks you off a mountain, or if, let's say, you twist your ankle a mile down the trail, you get back to the parking lot and discover your car battery is dead, so you activate an SOS. If troopers were to send a taxi to come get you, that driver would certainly expect payment, and that's probably not a common sort of search and rescue mission, but just to make the point that you're speaking just for military assets. And there's another realm of cost here regarding these devices, and that's the purchase price and whatever service fees go along with it. What would you say to someone who thinks the retail cost isn't worth the investment?
Well, I would ask how much your life is worth. You spend thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars on aircraft, on boats, on four-wheelers, on snow machines, on hiking equipment. So the cost of a $300 PLB, say, absolutely can be the difference between life or death.
Lieutenant Colonel Scott Milani, thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, you're absolutely welcome.
This has been Adventure Talks on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and if this topic has been of interest to you, Chris Hanna and I will be giving a presentation Friday about our experience on the Harding Ice Field and having the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center come to our aid. That will be at 7 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center, once again on Friday. We'll have some slides and a presentation and time for questions and answers. So if you want to put a little thought into safety in the backcountry, this would be a good chance to do so. Thanks for joining us today. We hope to see you Friday. Until then, stay safe.